The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Golden Age of Polish Jewry, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Reb Psachya Meir ben Reb Avrom Olav HaSholom, Mr. Psachya Hertzberg, of blessed memory.
For Jews the world over, the mention of the name Poland or Lithuania brings with it a flood of emotion, both positive and negative. On the one hand, Poland and Lithuania were home to generations of gifted scholars and deeply religious thinkers. Open up the back pages of any volume of the Talmud, you'll come to face with some of those great minds. The commentaries of Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, of Shmuel Edels, the Marshal, or Mayor of Lublin, the Maharam, which were created in the 16th and 17th century Poland, are invaluable aids for virtually every Talmudic scholar. Open up any volume of the Arba Turim, the Tur, written by Rav Yaakov ben Rabbeinu Osher in the 14th century in Spain, and you'll find, in addition to Rav Yosef Karo's commentary, which is called the Beis Yosef, three additional classic commentaries all written in Poland. The Darkei Moshe of Rav Moshe Isserles, he lived between 1530 and 1572. The Beis Chodesh of Rav Yoel Sirkis. Sirkis, his mother's name was Sora, so it's Sirkis. Rav Yoel, he lived between 1561 and 1640. And the Drishan Prisha of Rav Yeshua Falk, who lived between 1550 and 1640. They were all Polish scholars. Open up a Shulchan Aruch. Which is Rav Yosef Karo's concise compendium of Jewish law, together, which is written together with Rav Moshe Isserles' glosses. And flanked on both sides of the Shulchan Aruch are the works of Polish or Lithuanian scholars. On Aruch Chaim, that part of the Shulchan Aruch, which deals with daily ritual and prayers, Shabbos and holidays, the page is flanked on one side by the Turei Zohar, written by Rav David Segal, who lived between 1587 and 1667, and the other side by the Sefer Mogen Avrom, written by Rav Rom Abeli Gombiner, who lived between 1637 and 1683. Again, these are the classics, if you were learning Aruch Chaim. These were the things you'd be looking at, and this is what's quoted. It's a Taz, this is the acronym for Terezov, or the Mogen Avrom. Yoredeya, that part of the Shulchan Aruch which deals with Kashrus, Taras HaMashpacha, family purity, Nidorim, vows, Avelis, mourning, and a whole range of other topics, is flanked on one side by the Terezov, again, of David Segal, on the other side by the Sifsei Kohen, was written by Rav Shafsei Kohen, who lived between 1622 and 1663. It is known as the Shach, which is the acronym of that work. Sifsei Kohen, the Shin, and the Chof. It's called Shach. Choshen Mishpat, that part of the Shulchan Aruch deals with monetary law, is flanked on one side by the Sefer Me'ires Einayim, written by Rav Yeshua Falk. And again, he was the author of the Drisha and the Prisha. On the tour. Again, he lived between 1550 and 1640. On the other side is the Shach. Evan Ezer, on family law, is flanked on one side by the Sefer Chelkas Mechokek, written by Ramosha Lima, who lived from 1605 to 1658. The other side by the Beis Shmuel, written by Shmuel Feivush, who lived between the years 1650 and 1700. On the upper right side of every volume of the Shulchan Aruch, you know, the complete set, you know, with all the commentaries, is the commentary of the Be'er HaGola, which provide Baragola is the wellsprings of the exile, which provides us with the source material for the rulings of Rav Yosef Karo of Moshe Israelis, as it cites where you find these, what their sources were. It was written by Moshe Rivkus, as his mother was Rivka, an ancestor of the famed Vilner Gaon, who died around the year 1672. You notice they all lived around a certain period of time. That was really the golden age, for the most part, of Polish and Lithuanian Jewry. Poland and Lithuanian scholars provide enlightened spiritual guidance for well over 400 years, well up until the Holocaust and beyond. On the other hand, there are very few lands that are as drenched with Jewish blood like Poland and Lithuania. The cumulative suffering of the Jewish people in those lands, culminating with the Holocaust, the Churban, the destruction of European Jewry in World War II, is shocking beyond belief. In a subsequent lecture, we will cover the forerunner of the Holocaust. This is the Shnas Tach V'Tat, the Chmelnytsky massacres of the year 1648 and 49, and the subsequent massacres that occurred in the following decade. Tonight, however, I'd like to describe the Golden Age of Poland. Jewish life in Poland, Lithuania during the 16th up to the middle of the 17th century, and the conditions that enabled them to reach such a level of intellectual eminence. I would first like to go over really the political background of Poland. In the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, as Germany was becoming less and less hospitable for Jews, the Kingdom of Poland, still a backwater economically and culturally, opened up its doors and provided a needed haven for the Jews. Eager for the talents, business acumen, and connections of the Jews, the kings of Poland offered the Jews privileges and rights that were virtually unavailable for them anyplace else on earth. The first to grant them official rights was Bolesław Pobożny, or as called Pius, the Duke of Kalisz, the King of Greater Poland, in the year 1264. In other words, they divided Poland really into two parts. Great Poland, which was around Kalisz, Lublin, and was Little Poland, which was around Krakow. Although these rights were initially limited to the city of Kalisz and the surrounding areas known as Great Poland, in the year 1334, the Polish King Kazimierz III, known as Kazimierz the Great, amplified and expanded them to include the entire Empire of Poland. In the wake of the Black Plague, which happened in the middle of the 14th century, as more German Jews escaped to Poland, the communities of Kalisz, Krakow, Posen, Lwów, or Lemberg began to emerge as major Jewish centers. At the same time, Lithuania started to become a Jewish haven, as the cities of Brisk, or Brest-Litovsk, Ludmir, and Kiev, even though it's in the Ukraine but was then under Lithuanian rule, began to develop. Kazimierz died in the year 1370 without a male heir. Eventually, his nephew, Louis I of Anjou, King of Hungary, came to the throne. In the year 1384, 2 years after the death of Louis, his daughter Jadwiga, was crowned Queen of Poland. A few short years later, in the year 1386, she married Jagiello, Grand Duke of Lithuania, who was a pagan at the time. Lithuania was the last country in Europe to become Christian. And upon the marriage, he converted to Catholicism, thus initiating the process of making Lithuania the final country in Poland to adopt Christianity. They became Catholics. And in effecting a quasi-merger between Poland and Lithuania. At that point, they were still independent, but they merged because the King of Poland was also the Grand Duke of Lithuania. But Lithuania still had some sort of autonomy for another 100 years. Jagiello now became, changed his name to Władysław II, King of Poland, leaving his cousin, Vytautas, or Witold, in charge of Lithuania. In that year, Witold, now in control of Lithuania, issued a charter similar to Casimir's charter, which spelled out the rights and privileges of the Jews within his domain, within Lithuania. We produce some of the of that document on the first page of your notes. This is paragraph A. This is taken from the document. Number 7, as these are the lists of the clauses here, in the 7th paragraph, the city's magistrate is not allowed to sit in judgment in cases involving litigation between two Jews. Paragraph 9, if a Christian murders a Jew, he should be punished in accordance with his crime without mercy. His property should be confiscated by the state. I mean, just evidently by the fact that they needed to spell these out. In other places, these rights did not exist. 10. If a Christian hits a Jew, but does not kill him, he should be punished in the same manner as if he struck a member of the nobility. 11. One is not allowed to harm a Jew who is traveling from place to place. It continues on, the tax that is to be levied on a Jew's merchandise should not be more than that which is levied for the other citizens of the city. This was 1386. Twelve, no tax shall be levied for transporting the dead from place to place. 14, one who attacks a synagogue shall pay a fine to our magistrate of 2 liters of pepper. Evidently, pepper was hard to get in those days. 22. The rabbinic court of the Jews, the Beis Din, shall convene in the synagogue or any other place of their choice. 26. One who kidnaps a Jewish child shall be punished in the same manner as any kidnapper. 31. It is forbidden to accuse Jews of the crime of killing a Christian child in order to eat his blood, for it is clear it is forbidden for Jews to eat any form of blood. And again, as we said, from the list of rights, we have an idea of the repeated injustices that were done to the Jews in other areas and times. All during this time, the church, together with the citizens of the cities, many of German descent, put increasing pressure on the government to deny the Jews these rights that were guaranteed them under the charter. In Posen, the Jews were accused of inducing a Christian woman to steal 3 hosts. As a host means the wafers used in the church service, which the Christians believe contained within it the body of Yeshu. Now, there's one of the doctrines of the church is the doctrine of transubstantiation. That the body of Yeshu goes into the wafer, and his blood goes into the wine, and they drink the wine and the wafer. But they really believe that that he's there, and if you'd stab it, blood would come out. Afterwards, they supposedly, the Jews who got hold of these 3 hosts, stabbed the host until it bled and then threw it into a ditch where various miracles are supposed to have occurred. The Bishop of Posen ordered the Jews to answer the charges. After long continued torture on the rack, the 13 elders of the community were burnt slowly at the stake. In addition, a permanent fine was imposed on the Jews of Posen, which they were required to pay to the Dominican order, which they rigorously collected until the 18th century. And they wonder why more Jews didn't embrace the warmth and love of the church. This is only one incident. There are many, many more. In the reign of Władysław II and his son, in the reign of his son, successor Władysław III, the original rights issued to the Jews were all but discarded. To make matters worse, at the beginning of the reign of their successor, Casimir IV, a fire broke out in the city of Posen, which destroyed the entire city, including the original charter, which was issued by Casimir III. You know, now it reminds me of, you know, they say about what Yogi Berra said about this is an oral contract. It's not worth the paper it's written on. In response to the pleas of a number of Jewish delegations from several communities, Casimir IV issued them a new charter to ensure their rights. In fact, it seems to have been broader in its scope than the original charters that preceded it. On the top of page 2, we quote from that charter. We, is the royal we, Casimir IV, the King of Poland, the Grand Duke of Lithuania, Pomerania, and Russia, the Russia they're referring to is not what we call today Russia, but what would be the Pale. In other words, Galicia, Ukraine, Podolia, Volyn, hereby inform the people that a delegation of Jews, faithful servants of our kingdom, came before us and explained to us that they had been under royal protection as a result of the document of privileges issued to them by Casimir the Great, King of Poland. It is our desire that the Jews who are protected by the wings of our love and compassion shall also enjoy the fruits of the success of our kingdom for our good and the good of our treasury. Note that. We, therefore, hereby confirm and substantiate these previously issued privileges and are putting them into writing in an official document to preserve them so that they endure forever and ever. In 1454, in other words, he took reign in 1447, Casimir. In 1454, Cardinal Zbigniew Osnicki, Archbishop of Krakow, wrote the following to Casimir, as he was not happy about the privileges issued to the Jews. Quote, "Do not think that you are to decree whatever you please in matters of the Christian religion. No man is so great or so powerful that he may not be opposed in the cause of religion. Hence, I beg and implore your majesty to repeal the privileges and rights in question." End quote. Joining forces with the papal nuncio, Saint Juan of Capistrano, he was a Russia Marusha, and the blood that's on San Juan of Capistrano's hands is immense. The archbishop successfully had the privileges annulled. Conditions did not improve during the reign of Casimir IV's successor, John Albert. In the year 1495, Alexander Jagiellon, Grand Duke of Lithuania, and John Albert's brother, expelled the Jews from his domain. This was supposedly based on the charge that his wife, and it was Alexander's wife, who was barren, was a subject of a hex imposed upon her by a Jewish sorceress, and therefore all of the Jews in Lithuania were felt to be a menace. For various reasons, in the year 1503, after he succeeded his brother to the throne as King of Poland, Alexander allowed the Jews to return to Lithuania, even granting them their original possessions and the right to collect all that was owed them. And this is, here we produce this on page 2 in paragraph C. Although conditions were not stable, life in Poland was still better than in almost all of Europe. At the same time, the arrival of Rav Yaakov Polak, one of Jewry's foremost scholars in Poland, laid the foundation for Poland's golden age. On the bottom of page 2, we quote the royal confirmation of his position as chief rabbi of Krakow and all of Poland. His life, as well as that of his disciple, Shalom Shachna, was a subject of a previous lecture. From that time on, Poland became not only a major commercial center, but a tourist center as well. Conditions further improved in the year 1506 with the ascension to the Polish throne of King Sigismund I, who was well disposed to the Jews. This favorable attitude continued in the reign of his son and successor, Sigismund II, who reigned between 1548 and 1572. After 3 Jews were killed in the city of Sochaczew on charge of desecrating the host, again, this is the wafer that's used in the Catholic Mass, King Sigismund issued the following order, which we find on page 3, which is on paragraph E of your notes, is on top of page 3. Sigismund August, through the grace of God, the King of Poland, the Duke of Lithuania, and Russia, we are hereby putting into law a statute for all time that anyone who accuses Jews of killing a Christian child or of desecrating the sacred wafer shall not bring the case before a nobleman, magistrate, lord, governor, any official, nor through any ruler or priest, but rather the Jew shall remain free under the jurisdiction of his townsmen until he be brought to us, the royal court. He who accuses the Jew must bring 3 Christian witnesses and 3 Jewish witnesses. If he fails to produce such witnesses, he shall be severely punished. His blood will be spilled and his property confiscated. Evidently, it was a deterrent. King Sigismund also tried to intervene on behalf of Jewish merchants who were not allowed to trade with Russia. Russia, here we mean what we call Russia. Not, in other words, Mother Russia. He, however, was not successful. I mean, just as an aside, maybe it's worthwhile to read the. This is really taken from the letters that went from King Sigismund to King Ivan the Fourth, King Ivan the Terrible of Russia. You forbade the Jewish merchants from coming to your kingdom. This is what the Polish king is writing, which causes much harm to our treasury. Even though it is explicitly written in the peace treaty that our merchants are permitted to bring merchandise to the city of Moscow without interference, just as your merchants in our land. The response from Ivan. We have written to you many times and informed you of the evil deeds of the Jews who are turning our people away from Christianity. How can we permit the Jews to enter our land? And he says other thing that we poison them as well and other wonderful things. It's interesting, in the century before, in the 15th century, there was a Italian Jew, this was Zacharia, who was a diplomatic liaison to the Mongol Khan. And in Novgorod, he was responsible for converting 2 prominent priests, Denis and Alex, to Judaism. And they in turn went and proselytized amongst the populace and created a whole pro-Jewish religion to the extent that the Grand Duke of Moscow, his daughter-in-law, was no longer a Christian. In 1506, the Russian Orthodox Church took firm action and really destroyed brutally all those who were involved in this. And because of this, because of that movement, the Russians were frightened of the Jews because they're afraid if we allow the Jews in, they are going to destroy Russian Orthodoxy. And this is really what what Ivan is referring to. After the death of Sigismund II, the Jagiellō dynasty came to an end. From then on, the kings were elected, as it was no longer went through succession, blood succession, but they were elected by the Szlachta, the petty nobility of Poland. And this gave tremendous power to the nobility. The first of the newly elected kings was Henry of Anjou, brother of the King of France, Charles the Ninth. His election was decided, interestingly enough, through the influence of Shlomo Ashkenazi, the former physician to King Sigismund, who at the time was in charge of foreign affairs for the Turkish government. Henry's reign only lasted a few months, however, as he left Poland to succeed his deceased brother to the French throne. In 1576, Stephen Báthory, a close friend of the Jews, was elected king. Báthory's successor, Sigismund III, who reigned between 1587 and 1632, although a protector of the Jesuits in the church, was also favorably disposed to the Jews. It was in this atmosphere that Polish Jewry reached its zenith in Torah. Let me read to you a few passages from the work Yevein HaMetzula, which we're going to quote extensively in the next lecture, written by Rav Nosson Nota of Hanover, how he described Jewish life during this period. This is again before the Chmelnytsky uprising. There's no need to offer proof for something that is common knowledge. There was never so much Torah learning throughout the whole diaspora, through all of the diaspora of Israel, as in the land of Poland. Every single community supported a yeshiva. They would give sufficient support to their Rosh Yeshiva so it would be able to conduct the studies without financial worry, so the study of Torah would be his sole occupation. You have to realize this occurred at a time when the Jews were blessed financially. In a later period, after the Chmelnytsky uprising, there was tremendous poverty. The Rosh Yeshiva would never leave his home throughout the year except to go to and from the Beis HaMedrash, to the study hall, to the Beis HaKnesses, the synagogue. He would sit there day and night and would be involved only in Torah study. Every community would support Bochrim, older students, and provide them with a fixed weekly income so they would be able to study with the Rosh Yeshiva. They would also give each Bochur at least two young boys, younger students, to teach in order to articulate the Gefes. It was called Gefes as an acronym of Gemara, as the Talmud, Pirish, the basic commentary, normally it's Rashi, and Tosafos, the additional commentaries, the deeper commentaries of the Tosafos, the additions. This was written by the French and German rabbis, of the 12th and 13th century. And in order to articulate the Gefes that he studied, in order to become accustomed to Pilpul. And this, again, we discussed at length in a previous lecture about the Pilpul, the casuistry, the logical and perhaps contrived thinking that was common during the time. They would give the boys food from the charity fund or from a special food collection. The community consists of 50 balabatim householders. They would support at least 30 bachurim and boys. One bachur with two boys would stay at the home of a householder. At the very least, the bachur would eat on a regular basis at his table like one of his family. Even though the bachur, as the elder student, had a sufficient stipend from the community, the householder would as a rule not charge him for the food and drink that he needed. Some of the generous householders would treat the boys like members of the family, provide all three of them with food and drink throughout the year. Continued on, there's almost no home in all of Poland where Torah was not learned. Either the householder was a scholar, or a son, or son-in-law were scholars, or a bocher, as his elder student, was a member of his household. Sometimes all of the above together existed in one house. They fulfilled all three things that Rava stated in the second chapter of the Tractate Shabbos. This is in Chav Gimel and Beis in 23b. Rava said, "He who has compassion for rabbis will have children that will be rabbis. He who honors rabbis will have sons-in-law as rabbis. And he who is in awe of rabbis will himself become a rabbi." That is why there are many scholars in every single community. In a community of 50 householders, there are 20 scholars who had the title Morenu, or Chover. The Rosh Yeshiva towered above them, and all of the scholars were subservient to him, and they go to him to study in the yeshiva. Again, describing the idea of Kovod HaTorah, the honor they gave to the Torah. In every community, the Rosh Yeshiva was highly honored. Whether one was rich or poor, his words were followed, and no one dared oppose him. Figuratively, no one lifted his hand or foot without his permission. What he decreed became law. He had the power to inflict corporal punishment, to fine and publicly shame those who violated the law, and to institute legislation in order to ensure the moral integrity of the community. Despite all of this, they loved the Rosh Yeshiva. If one would have a choice piece of food, such as chicken, he would give half or all of it away to the Rosh Yeshiva. They would constantly honor him with other gifts such as money, silver, gold, specially fed cattle or fowl or fish of superior quality. Also in the synagogue, most of the people who purchased mitzvahs would honor the Rosh Yeshiva with a mitzvah. The Rosh Yeshiva had the chiyuv, the automatic right, to shlishi, the third aliyah on Shabbos, and at least the first day of Yom Tov. If the Rosh Yeshiva was a Kohen or Levi, his chiyuv His obligation was the Aliyah of Kohen or Levi or Achron. This was the case even though there were many Kohanim or Leviim in the synagogue, but he always got that Aliyah, that be called to the Torah. And again he continues, no one left the synagogue on Shabbos or Yom Tov until the Rosh Yeshiva first departed, followed by the student body of his yeshiva. Afterwards, the rest of the community would leave and would escort him all the way to his house. At the onset of Yom Tov, everyone would walk over to his house in order to welcome the approach of the holiday. The great honor afforded the Rosh Yeshiva would serve as an incentive for all of the scholars who would constantly devote themselves to study so that they too would reach such a level as to be appointed a Rosh Yeshiva in some community. As the Talmud points out, the observance and study of Torah for an ulterior motive will eventually lead to observance and study for its own sake. Through this, the whole country became filled with a knowledge of the Torah. And it continues on, no man left in the morning to his business without hearing words of Torah delivered by a scholar, whether it be Rashi's commentary to the Torah, prophets or holy writings, or Mishnayos, or practical halacha. Each one studied according to the desire of his heart. It was also during this period that Poland and its environs developed a form of self-government known as the Council of the Four Lands. They would convene at the fair, the Yerid, where rabbinic scholars and their students would come together from all over the country, all over the countryside, to study and discuss matters of Torah, and where merchants would come to do business and have their legal issues settled by the Beis Din, the rabbinic court of law. The fair was also a meeting for the entire Jewish populace. This is how Rav Nosson Nota Hanover described it. Afterwards, this is referring to the end of the normal semester in the yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, together with the students of the yeshiva, both the older and younger students, would travel to the fair. In the summer, they would travel to Zaslav and Yaroslav, which is in Galicia, and in the winter to the fairs of Lvov, Lemberg, and Lublin. At every fair, there were hundreds of Rosh Yeshivas, the heads of the yeshivas, and many thousands of Bachurim, elder students, and many myriads of young students. So the yeshivas would be in session. They would be able there really to go under, to visit, to hear shiurim, lectures from other Rosh Yeshivas. Because normally they were just in their city, and they heard their teachers. But here everyone came together so you could now hear, you know, the teachings of others. There were in attendance Jewish and non-Jewish merchants as plentiful as the sand at the seashore. From one end of the world to the next, people would come to the fair. One who had a son or a daughter to marry off would travel there, would make a match. You know, maybe we should do this. Each one would find out what they were looking for and their proper mate. Hundreds of matches would be made at each fair, and at times thousands. The country of Poland was like Jerusalem before its destruction, when courts were set up in every city, and if one refused to be judged by the court of his city, he went to the nearest court, and refused to be judged by the nearest court, he went before the great court. That's in that area. Thus, in the capital city of Ostrow, you know, it was this. You know, it's the English is Ostrog, because in Russian there's no H, and the H is a G, but the original was Ostrow. So, you know, people with the name of Ostrow, they come from that. This was the capital of Volin. There was the great court for Volinia. And in the Ukraine, the capital, this was the, excuse me, Ostrog was for Volin and Ukraine. And in the capital of Lvov, which was called Lemberg, there was the court for Little Russia. As Little Russia means, you know, the area of Galicia, Podolia. There were thus many communities, each of which had a great court for its own province. And if the important communities had a dispute between them, they would let themselves be judged by the heads of the Council of the Four Lands, who would be in session twice a year. In other words, so in every district, you had the final, you had recourse to the greatest court of the land. But if it would be a dispute between the communities, then they would go to the central court. One leader would be chosen from each important community to this council. Added to these were six Gaonim, great scholars from the land of Poland. And these were, and this together, that was the council. The representatives of the four lands had sessions twice in the year at the fair in Lublin, it was in Poland between Purim and Passover, and the fair of Yaroslav in Galicia in the month of Av or Elul. The leaders of the four lands resembled the Sanhedrin in the chamber of hewn stone, the Galicia Sagosis, in the temple of Jerusalem. They had jurisdiction over all of the Jews of the Kingdom of Poland, with power to issue injunctions and binding decisions and to impose penalties at their discretion. Every difficult case was submitted to them for trial. To make the task easier for themselves, the representatives of the four lands would select special judges from each land who were called district judges, who tried civil suits. While criminal cases, disputes over priority of position, chazoka, and other difficult cases were tried by the leaders of the four lands themselves. Never was a dispute among Jews brought before a Gentile judge or before a nobleman or before the king, may his glory increase. And if a Jew took his case before a Gentile court, he was punished and chastised severely. Every community appointed men in charge of weights and measures and of other business dealings so that everything would be conducted according to truth and trustworthiness. Again, Rav Hanover was describing life in the middle of the 17th century before the Chmelnytsky massacre. The special place of the reed seems to date at least before this, at least the century before, in the middle of the 1500s. And again, I quote from, you know, from various responsa. This is again, it's from the middle of the 1500s here. I mean, you could look at the other things on page 8, number 2. We will issue our opinions, this is from the Rama, in the matter of advice and to follow it. They should suspend, this was a ongoing argument between two sides. They should suspend all litigation until the fair at Lublin and have the court there resolve the burning issues that are consuming them. In addition, the contending parties should annul all of the execrations, I mean the curses, and writs of excommunication against each other. The parties should then come together before the court for adjudication at the coming fair at Lublin. Because at that time, it was the major court, and the greatest scholars were there. In another response, it says, both parties should come, the Rama writes, to the coming fair at Lublin to adjudicate their issues before the court. Just to have a sense of how everyone came to the court, I quote on the top of page 9, the Maharsha, which we will discuss at the end of this lecture, one of the great scholars. He was really at the end of his life, he was the chief rabbi of Ostrog. But he is the author of one of the major commentators of the Talmud. He says, from here, he was writing from, this is Shabbos in 75b, until the end of the chapter, which is 76b, I did not see fit to include my insights. I did not study at the time in the yeshiva as I was then at the fair at Lublin. That was because he was one of the judges, so he was totally occupied. So his insights were not worked through the yeshiva, because he just wanted to put in writing all that had been already discussed, that went through peer review, so to speak. Because that which was his own, he was afraid, and he didn't want to write it. And again, he writes similarly, he writes in the Masechta the Sanhedrin. Although the earliest official document of the Vad Arba Rotzos, of a council, is dated the 15th of Kislev, 5341, and is November 22nd, 1580. As early as the year 1533, we find in official governmental records that a case involving Jews from different parts of Lithuania, Bielesk and Horodno, this probably was Grodno, was adjudicated by a court of Rabbonim who came to the city of Lublin. Since not only were the merchants not local, but the rabbinic judges as well, it would seem that it occurred at the time, you know, it didn't say, but at the time of the Yerid, the fair, and evidently the idea of having everyone coming to the fair, both the rabbinic scholars, and the was dated even before we have an official document. Originally, it was called the Council of Three Lands. The three lands being Poland. Again, Poland really, which could be, the, you know, is really was really of two parts. Great Poland was near Kalisz, Lublin. The capital was Posen. And Little Poland, whose capital was Krakow. The second of the three was Lithuania. And the third was Russia, again, not Mother Russia, but was it referred to the lands of Volyn, whose capital was Ostrog, or Kremenets, Podolia, and Galicia, whose capital was Lemberg or Lvov. Such a grouping we find in the approbation, the Askoma for printing the Talmud in Lublin, which was issued in the year 1559. And again, we could read this, it gives you a sense of the what was happening with the full agreement of all the Gaonim and Rosh Yeshivas of the three lands, Poland, Russia, and Lithuania. They instituted a binding enactment that every yeshiva throughout the three lands should study one tractate after the next as they are being printed with the help of God in order to spread Torah in Israel and in order to strengthen our hand in this holy work. In other words, this was the opening inscription of the volumes of the Talmud that were printed in Lublin. They were printed in succession according to what would be studied in the yeshiva. And of course, they had, if you, as we read before, we have all these Rosh Yeshivas and Bachurim, and you had a lot of people studying. Up until 1623, Lithuania was part of this council. After that, they created their own central organization, which acted independently. These dual independent councils remained in effect until the government officially disbanded both of them in the year 1764. Again, since Lithuania was no longer part of this Vlad, the council, and really we had two lands now instead of three, really, again, it was just a question of numbering them. For a case of numbering, it was Poland was divided into two parts. And as you had Greater Poland, which the capital is Posen. So you had Smaller Poland, which the capital is Krakow. And then the other two are Volyn, which the capital is Ostrog. And Russia, which meant Galicia, Podolia, which the capital was Lvov, Lemberg. So these were the four lands. Lithuania now was separate. Again, you could look on your own, you know, the various rulings from these lands. But I would like to just give you a sense of what were the kind of takonis, legislation of the council. Here, like, turn to page 12. The leadership of the Council of the Four Lands has agreed, because of certain unscrupulous individuals, who can potentially endanger our community, to forbid tax farming in Greater and Lesser Poland, whether from the king or from the nobility. They should not pay for the privilege of the mints, that's minting, or farm taxes which are paid for crossing the border. I.e. the tax of crack or pose in adjacent areas. In other words, they shouldn't farm the taxes. It creates tremendous ill will. Let someone else take over the taxes. In no way is a Jew allowed to pay for this privilege. Anyone who defies this edict will be excommunicated from both worlds. I mean, you just have the idea what the excommunication was. Should we separate from the entire sanctity of Israel, his bread shall be considered like that of the Samaritans. You can't eat his bread. His wine shall be deemed nesach. You can't drink his wine. This is if it would be poured before the idols, and his shechita shall be deemed nevela. This is as if it wasn't, that the ritual slaughter should be considered invalid. No rov shall officiate his marriage, nor at the marriage of his sons or daughters. No one is allowed to intermarry with them. He shall be cursed and execrated with all of the curses and execrations which are written in the Sefer Torah, till he desists from his evil ways and follows the words of the teachers of Torah. This was written in the year 1581. If Lithuania was considered part of that, You know, then you'd have to say that the that Volin and Russia were all considered one. Now, again, it's just a question of numbering, but yeah, because we know that they separated as a separate thing in 1623. So it would seem at this point they were still part of the four lands. And they kept the name after Othoniel left, so now that they called, it's just a question of naming. I mean, they all came from the same area in any case. Here, this is about printing a work without a rabbinic approbation. No printer shall print any work without the permission of the Rabbonim and the leaders of the four lands. This is already enacted in 1590. If the printer violates this enactment, he should be excommunicated with all those who were involved. And this was from 1594. In page 13 here in paragraph C, is forbidden to pay for the privilege of being an arenda, agent of a nobleman, in a situation where that position is already occupied by another Jew. Even if the nobleman or ruler has appointed his own son to be in his stead, to be the ruler of that place, the previous contract is still considered to be in effect. And it's forbidden for anyone else to pay for the privilege. And you shouldn't say, well, now the old nobleman is no longer here, like he appointed his son. So therefore, another one can go and push you can't push the person out. After the death of the nobleman, however, it is no longer forbidden to pay for the privilege of being an arenda. In other words, as long as the first nobleman is alive and another Jew paid, an arenda was a middleman. This was an agent, and he paid for the privilege. As long as the first one is alive, even though he may have appointed his son, he's still really considered in charge, and another one can't move in. However, when the nobleman died, it becomes a new administration, then it's open again, another Jew can vie for the position. As long as the original contract of the arenda is already expired. In other words, if the contract expired in the life of the nobleman, then the privilege of renewing it belongs to the one who previously held the contract. No one is allowed to mix in. However, it's already a new administration, then they did allow room, but they wanted to make sure that if everyone keeps on bidding the position, not only will there be no job security, but it will become financially ruinous. You know, to become an agent, they have to pay for the privilege, and everyone is going to be bidding against the other one. That's true, but the ones that they trusted with this position were Jews, and by and large, the arendas were Jews. So, as we're going to really go in greater detail in the next lecture. The lands were owned by this nobility, and they were absentee landlords, and they trusted the Jews to be their middlemen. And, of course, it came through many problems, and these were the takonas, these were announcements to assure that there would be orderly, that it would be done in an orderly manner. In addition, it's important to note that in the reign of Stephen Bathory, who reigned from 1576 to 1586-87, the collection of taxes for the Jewish populace was put entirely in the hands of the Vad Arba Arutzis. Those are the Council of the Four Lands. This now became an additional function of the Vad. Not only were they there to create enactments to deal with legal issues, but they were the official arm of the government, so to speak. They were the ones responsible for the collection of taxes, and when it came to taxes, it was no mean feat in order to divide the responsibilities of the taxes. In addition, the council sent professional shtadlonim, agents, to lobby on behalf of the Jewish community, especially during the session of the Polish Sejm. This is parliament. By the means of entreaties, money, presents, privileges for the Jews were maintained or in some cases expanded. All because of the shtadlonim. The word shtadlonim really comes from the word lehishtadel, which means to try. because basically all they could do is try. There are no guarantees. And so therefore, all the person was just called a shtadlan, a trier. For this, a special fund was created. It was funded by dues paid by each of the four lands. This was especially necessary at the coronation diet, or the legislative session when the new king was crowned. And the king then was expected to confirm the ancient rights and privileges which were granted the Jews by their predecessors. Because now he is beginning, he's setting the tone of his reign. Anti-Jewish forces of the Diet worked very hard to attempt to have these privileges curtailed. So it was very important for the Shtadlonim, to be involved. It would be fitting at this time to briefly describe the life of one of the most famous of the Shtadlonim, the Jewish advocates, Rav Shaul Katzenelnbogen, known as Shaul Val. As I guess most scholars assume that it's the same person. Rav Shaul was the son of one of the greatest scholars of the age, Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelnbogen, chief rabbi of Padua, Italy, who in turn was the son of Rav Meir of Padua, the recognized elder scholar of his generation, who was a disciple of Yaakov Polak. He was also a cousin of Rav Moshe Isserles, a distant cousin, Moshe Isserles, the Ramah, and Rav Shlomo Luria, the Marshal. The Katzenelnbogen is a small town in Germany from whence Rav Meir of Padua originally came. So that became the name, and even to this day it's a famous, it is the name of very famous rabbinic families. Rav Shaul Katzenelnbogen as a young man traveled from his native Italy to Lithuania to study in the yeshiva Brisk, or Brest-Litovsk. While he was studying in yeshiva, a Lithuanian nobleman, Count Radzivill, after traveling through Europe, happened to find himself in Padua, Italy, temporarily without any funds. He lost his Visa card. As a Lithuanian nobleman, he was is quite used to having Jews fund his spending habits. And therefore, Radzivill naturally made his way to the chief rabbi of the city, Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelnbogen, and asked for his help. Again, this is the middle of the 1500s. Rav Katzenelnbogen lent him an appreciable sum of money and told Radzivill that he, when he returns to Lithuania, should repay that sum directly to his son, Rav Shaul, who he told him was studying in Brisk, not far from his estates. Radzivill eventually made his way back to Lithuania and paid the money back. In the process, he got to meet and was very much impressed by the Rav's son, Rav Shaul Katzenelnbogen. Eventually, Rav Shaul became Radzivill's close advisor and confidant, and used that position to become the Shtadlan, the intercessor, for all of the Jews of Poland. It was through his influence after the death of Stephen Bathory in 1587 that Sigismund III was chosen to be Bathory's successor. Legend has it that during the interregnum, it was between the time that Sigismund died, that Bathory died, and Sigismund was crowned king, in order that Poland should not remain without a king, even for a night, Rav Shaul was chosen temporarily to be king. The next day, Sigismund took the position. He was also known as Rav Shaul Val. Some say the word Val, is based upon the fact that he was voted as a temporary king. The word vol in Yiddish, voln, is vote. Another explanation is Val is Slavic, which means Italian, which is Rav Shaul's place of origin, Padua, Italy. He was said to have become extremely wealthy and influential. Through his influence with the Polish nobility and kings, he was said to have averted many potential tragedies, and through his wealth, he helped many of his fellow Jews. He merited to have a wonderful family. Many great rabbinic and communal figures were descended from him, and he died around the year 1620. We've described the state of Torah study and the central institutions of Jewry in Poland. I'd like to briefly discuss, to acquaint you with some of the great Torah personalities of that era. I'd like to touch upon three of those great personalities. The first one is Mordechai Yaffa. He was a leading figure in the Vat Arba Ratzis, in the council, and one of Jewry's leading scholars. And we begin here on page 13. In addition, in that generation, well, this is the Sefer Korei HaDoros from David Conforte, who wrote his work, you know, in the latter half of the 17th century. In that generation, in Germany, lived Mordechai Yoffe Ashkenazi, the author of the Levushim. He was a disciple of Moshe Isserles, the author of the Mappa, as he himself wrote in his work many times. He was an expert rabbinic scholar who integrated all forms of wisdom, whether in Kabbalah or science. He authored many works, as he himself wrote in his preface to the Levushim. And on page 14, we have from the Tzemach David, Rav David Gantz, who was a contemporary of his. Rav Mordechai Yoffe, this is the great rabbinic scholar who was outstanding both in the level of his general wisdom and his Torah knowledge, who carries high the banner of the camp of Israel. He authored the great work Levush Malchus, which includes all of the laws of the Talmud and later authorities. He also composed a commentary to the Torah's works of his homilies, drushes. In addition, he authored a work on the Mora Nevuchim, a guide to the perplexed by Maimonides, a work on the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctification of the new moon, by the Rambam, which is evident his scientific knowledge there, as well as a commentary to the Kabbalistic work by Rav Menachem Rikanti. He's assumed the position of Rosh Yeshiva and Rav for many years now, approximately 20 years, the community of Horodno. Again, this is Horodno's Grodno. You know, the H, there's no, again, it was originally H, but in the Russians took over, it became a G. Lublin and Kremenets has established many disciples. He is the chief of the esteemed Rosh Yeshiva and Dayanim, the rabbinic judges of the three lands. Again, he calls in terms of three lands. He came here to the city of Prague in the month of Iyar in the year 1592 and still dwells amongst us. May Hashem continue to ever increase his power. Again, this was written in 1592. And in another section, the word Tzemach David is a work on history. One part is Jewish history and the other is general history. The author of David Gans, we've touched upon him before, was a Talmud of the Ramah. He was a disciple of the Maharal of Prague. He was an astronomer. He was very close to Tycho Brahe. I mean, he was a very interesting person, this David Gans. In another section he writes, Mordechai Yoffe came to Prague some days after the Maharal of Prague left the city, which occurred on the 4th of Iyar, 1592, take the position for a second time as Rosh Yeshiva and Rav in Posen and all of Greater Poland. It's interesting, when the Maharal of Prague left and came back to Prague, Rav Mordechai Yoffe left, and he went to Posen. They made a switch. Again, you could read, it's interesting what I wrote, this is from the preface of Levush Malchus on the Shulchan Aruch, and his preface of Levush Ora on Chumash and Rashi. But just to touch upon, it's interesting that he was also a Kabbalist, a Makubal. And he weaved in the Kabbalah, in at least in some sections, when he spoke about the halach of Jewish law. And just to touch upon two interesting things. One is on page 16, paragraph F. One should not remove from the bag, you know, that contains the tefillin of the head before he puts on the tefillin of the arm. As you remove the tefillin of the arm, you put on the tefillin on the arm, and then you take out the tefillin of the rosh of the head. This is forbidden based upon the secrets of the teachings of Kabbalah. One possessed with intelligence will well understand the secret of the connection of the revealed with the hidden. This is connected to the secret of the muzzling of the ox, lest through that the power of judgment will prevail. As evidently he's assuming people were, at least some of them, would be familiar with this. Think it through. I'll leave it to you. And in another place he says, which is, this is a little more accessible, one should not perform the ceremony of Nephilis Apayim, falling on the face during the night. And those after one Daven Shemoneh Esrei on the weekday, if you're in a synagogue generally where there's a Sefer Torah, so there's a, if it's not a holiday or a special occasion, that one continues the prayers and one, it's this tachnun, it's a plea for forgiveness for the Jewish people, and one really, originally they used to really fall on their face, like, you know, we do on Yom Kippur. What has become now is really fall on your side. It's really, you don't fall, you sit down and put your hand on your side. But one should not do this during the night. The reason is that the purpose of the Nefilas Apayim is to subdue the governing force of the night, which is the attribute of judgment. If one were to perform the ceremony of Nefilas Apayim at night, when the attribute of judgment is overpowering, there's a fear that one's prayers would not be answered, because it's really, this is not the time of compassion. As a result, because of disappointment, one might be tempted to quote-unquote cut down the saplings, which is an expression meaning maintain there's a secondary independent negative force apart from Hashem. Because God is not ultimately, there's an opposing competitive force between good and evil. God represents good and there's an independent evil force. God forbid. It's well known to the scholars of Kabbalah, because why weren't my prayers answered? You'll attribute it, well, now God is no longer in session, so to speak. So don't even, this is not the time of compassion. At night, at the time of the watches, at the early morning, 4 hours before sunrise, it is the custom to perform the ceremony of Tefillas Apayim. In other words, on Slichas, if one says Slichas very early, one would fall on their face. It seems to me that the reason is that since it is so close to the day, and the governing attribute of the daytime, which is compassion, is in the process of manifesting itself, there is no fear of disappointment that would lead to cutting down the saplings. But again, it's just interesting that that the Kabbalah, even though he was not, this was not part of the Kabbalah of the Ari, this was really, it came from other, from the Rikanti, came from other sources, but it was very sensitive to it. And I said, we quote on page 17 from his gravestone, she died in the year 1612, in the third of Adar. We quote here on page 17, which we've quoted in a previous lecture, one of the enactments of the Vada of the Abra Rotsus, and here it was that one should not buy the rabbinical position. It says, in the year 5347, 1587, the market of Gromnitz. Gromnitz was really the holiday that preceded Easter. It says, in Lublin, a decree was issued that no Rav should attempt to obtain a rabbinic position through loans or gifts, but then personally through a proxy. And it goes on to that it really should only be obtained through merit alone. It was signed, it was in 1590 it was reenacted, and it was really signed by the leading lights of Poland at the time. There was Shlomo of Lublin, who was the Shalom's mentor, Yeshua Falk Katz, who was the author of Sefer Miris Einayim. He was a mentor of the Shalom. Rav Meir of Lublin, who was another mentor of the Shalom, as we've discussed the show in the previous lecture. Rav Shmuel Edels, the Marshal. Rav Ephraim of Lunshitz, who was the author of the Kli Yoker. Rav Yishayahu Horvitz, the Shalom. There are 26 rabbis in all. Rav Meir of Lublin, who was signed here, was one of the greatest of the Rabbonim during that period. He was the chief rabbi of Lublin. He was the Rosh Hashiva. On page 18 in paragraph B, from the Shem HaGadolim, from the Chidah, Chaim Yosef David Azuloy, describing him as the Maram of Lublin, the son-in-law of the Gom Rav Yitzchok HaKohen. He, as they point out, he really made an error here. We have in parentheses in the Hebrew, Chasana Goin Maral Mi Prague. He was the son-in-law of the son-in-law. It seems it's really not true. He was the son-in-law of Rav David Shapiro, who was the Av Beis Din and Rosh Hashiva of Krakow. And he composed the work Meir Einei Chachom on the Talmud. This is one of the most basic texts. One studies the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosvos. If the Maram was written on that tractate, probably would be the first place to look because it's so clear. He really takes you by the hand. And his response, because man here ain't a chachamim. Again, it seems like to Meir he enlightens the eyes of the scholars. He was a contemporary of the author of the Levush and the contemporary of the author of the Masas Binyamin. He passed away in the year 1616. He was, besides his responsibilities being Rosh Hashiva, he was, because of his brilliance and his knowledge, he was always writing tshuvas, he was always responding, and one of his responses that we have, if you think of any other question regarding Talmudic law and later rulings, I'm ready to respond to you, as well as to anyone who asks, these are the things I enjoy. On page 19, in paragraph 4, we have both an idea of what of the times as well as his own personal life regarding the case of a certain man who had the position of Arenda in Harodna for some years now, was expelled from there by the nobleman. The question is whether another man is allowed to purchase the privilege of being an Arenda or not. Because of the enormous difficulties that I face at present, as it being the semester, the Zman of the Yeshiva, I will answer you in brief. And he says, since he was expelled, the original Renda no longer has any rights to his former position. But again, you see his responsibilities as both as the Rav, to answer the questions, and as the teacher, the head of the yeshiva. And he writes in another response, and most of my disciples are heads of yeshivas and legal authorities in Israel. In other words, he was he had a tremendous influence. Another at the time was the Maharsha Rav Shmuel Edels. And again, if one studying the Talmud, this is besides the Maharsha is virtually in every tractate of the Talmud. And whereas the Maharam, in a certain sense, is very, he wrote it for the smallest of the students. This is very clear. It takes you by the hand. Maharsha is less clear, but in a certain sense is much more profound. And it used to be that when one studied, as a matter of course, when one studied Gemara Rashi Tosfos, one would always study the Maharsha. And it said, if you don't understand the Maharsha, you really don't understand. If you don't understand what he's saying, you don't understand the text itself. Because if you'd really understand it, you itself would be bothered by the question and really understand what he's saying. Unlike many of his generation, he was not involved in pilpul, just, you know, kazustri, just, you know, the back and forth, just his mind games. But he was really involved in what is the simple, best explanation of the text. In describing him on top of page 20, Rav Shmuel Edels, the Maharsha, an extraordinary rabbinic scholar, this is written by the Chidah, the Av Beis Din, the head of the rabbinic court of the community of Ostrov, passed away in the year 1631, and there was a mistake in the text. He composed Chiddush HaLochas, a commentary to most of the Talmud. Its shining light guides all of those who study Gemara and Tosfos in depth. His insights are quoted amongst the rabbis and their disciples, especially out Germany and Morocco, where it is especially beloved and is the focus of their studies. He also composed Chiddushei Agadot. It's a classic on the Agadot, on the philosophic, ethic, moral, explanatory works of the Bible that are explained in the Talmud. Is a major source for preachers and authors of homiletic works. I've also heard that he composed a work of responsa, which is not extant. It's interesting in terms of his relationship with the Maharam. We said before, to he whose radiance is like that of Moshe, this is Maharam, Rameir was writing to him, to my dear friend, the Mechutin, I guess their children married each other, the exalted prince, the pride of the generation, the lamp of Israel, the exilarch, the Rosh Masifta, Rav Shmuel Segel, may Hashem protect and redeem him. What happened in the past is over and done with. Evidently, they were two sides of a legal issue. Love has the power to cover all of our past sins, and we finally became fast friends. These are the words of one who's extremely harried, your mechutin and committed friend. And this is Rav Meir of Lublin. His mother-in-law, Adel, supported him and his large yeshiva for almost 20 years in the city of Posen. In her honor, he called himself by her name, Rav Shmuel Adels. In other words, he gave a tribute to his mother-in-law. After her death, he served in several cities in Poland. His last position was in Ostrog in Volin. It was a place of Torah before his days. The Marshal also, Rav Shlomo Luria, also served there more than a half a century beforehand. But through the Maharsha, it became a major Torah center. It became a popular saying that the city's name was actually made of two words. It was Ostro's Ois, Os, meaning a sign, and Torah, Os Torah. That's how they said Ostro's Os Torah, the sign or the letter of the Torah. There's an interesting story that is told that involves both the Maharam Lublin and the Maharsha. When the Maharam, mayor of Lublin, was Av Beis Din, the chief rabbi of the rabbinical court, and Rosh Yeshiva, head of the yeshiva in Lublin, there was another Rosh Yeshiva there, and as headed another yeshiva, by the name of Shimon Zev Oyerbach. He was the son-in-law of the Maharshal of Shlomo Luria. The Maharam and Shimon Zev once had a heated dispute regarding the Pshat, the proper explanation of a certain Tosfos on the Talmud. In order to resolve this passionate issue, the elders of the city of Lublin decided to send the question to the scholars of Amsterdam for resolution. They decided in the light of this machlokus, this controversy, and it was very bitter, that both couldn't stay in the city. That the Rav with whom the Amsterdam scholars would rule in accordance with shall remain the Rosh Yeshiva in Lublin, and the other will have to leave. At least this is how the story is told. The reply that they received from Shlomo Bohav of Amsterdam was in accordance with the opinion of Rav Oyerbach. And as a result, the Maharam prepared to leave the city. Uncomfortable with the entire matter, Rav Oyerbach also decided to quit the city, leaving now the city without a Rav. As their replacement, the city's elders decided to choose as their Rav Rav Shmuel Adels, the Marshal. Accepting their offer, the Marsha traveled from Ostrog to Lublin. Evidently, he sensed he came to the city and spoke to everybody. In his first drasha, his first public address, the Marsha stated that as Rav, as the rabbi, and Av Beis Din, the head of the rabbinic court of Lublin, it was his binding decision, after we've studied before, that the Rabbonim were king. That the community is required to take back both the Maharam of Oyerbach as Rosh Yeshiva, as heads of the yeshiva and Rabbonim. With that, the Marsha stepped down and subsequently left and went back home to Ostrog. And you can see how well beloved he was in his own city on page 21, is the last page of the notes. We have this is the inscription on the gravestone of Shmuel Adels. On the 5th of Kislev, in 1631, the holy man, the teacher of the king, died and was put to rest here. As an artisan, the son of an artisan, this is Nagar Bar Nagar, the wonder of the generation, the pure crown, the rabbinic scholar who was distinguished through his wisdom, humility, and his fear of God. He was renowned from one end of the world, this is like from the rising of the sun to the other, the setting of the sun. By virtue of his casuistry and his deep thinking and his incisiveness, he enlightened all of the scholars of Israel through his great work, the Chiddush HaLochas, in which he shared his novel insights of the Gemara and the commentaries of Rashi and Tosfos. The Gaon, the lamp of Israel, the glory of the generation, was Shmuel Eliezer Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, was asked to join the Heavenly Academy. He died through a divine kiss. His soul soared to heaven, was buried with honor on Sunday, the 5th of Kislev, 5392. Really, it's indicative of how he was held, how he was beloved by this city. Okay, now, are there any questions?
The court said how they supported the older brother,
It's not clear from the writing how old an older Bacher is. I assume it was up until the time he got married. So I assume it's his late teens and early 20s, I would assume, was thinking of a Bacher. After they got married, I guess it depended really on the support was given through the father-in-law. Here they're dealing with the support through the community. And there are those who continued in the cities. Generally, what happened was that they went to the cities of their father-in-laws and continued their study. And assuming that they had a relationship with the Rosh Yeshiva, they continued their study. You know, or if they were of the level, they themselves got a position. Yes. Because the question was about the relationship between the arenda and the nobleman. It was a position that one bid for. Because one really paid for that position, you know, and one, as the middleman, again, it was worked out in the pay structure. As the middleman, he had the privileges, and those who were under him had to pay him. Well, there's the question about expelling the arenda. Generally, if they would go to a court of law, the Jew would hold out the contract, and this is a contract. But the nobleman says, "I am the law." There was no law. They were the law. So a contract was only good based on the goodwill of the nobleman who was willing to maintain the contract. Right, but the question about the as a new source of income, but again, it's quite likely that the Jews would be reluctant to take the position. Because there was a certain communal bias over here. The payment of the contract was probably an ongoing thing. It wasn't just a lump sum. It was that the nobleman was assured of a certain percentage of all the income that would be coming in. If he gets rid of another one, there would be no advantage really to get rid of him, as the other Jew would come and would be basically the same price. As it wasn't your idea of to give him a lump sum. I think the payment was really based on a percentage of the income that would be coming in. So we're going to really discuss that at length in the next lecture. Right. He was the middleman, and he really all of that went on under the nobleman's estate, fishing, hunting, agriculture. Because all of that was really, he had a portion of that. And the nobleman had a portion as well. They had to figure out a pay structure. But really everything that was, the people there on the land were basically serfs. So the system was worked out, and we'll discuss that in greater length on the next lecture. Why did they suffer so much? Your question is during this that we find this mass migration from Germany to Poland. Why did the Jews suffer? The truth is about the question is we really don't have a definitive answer. We had quoted and we've touched upon different things in different lectures. It's a really very difficult thing to say with any definitive, you know, thing what the reason was. One interesting source that we had quoted before, and this is written by the Trumas Hadesh, and it was written in the 1400s, which was really the time of the migration, was he was describing that how the Jews had made, the living the Jews made in Germany was relatively easy. They were bankers. They lent money. And therefore, the profits there were quite large. It was not backbreaking work. It was easy for them. And there was a time that they supported Torah with great, quite generously to support Torah. And at that time, Germany was the center of Torah. When the Jews stopped supporting Torah, that's when the difficulties began for them. You know, so that's one thing. I don't know if this is the totality of this. It's really hard to say the truth. Right, right. This was really, this about the hatred of the Jews. Was that, that was why, at least in that period of time, they made this law that the Jews should not be the ones to collect taxes because of this. But this was always a, unfortunately, in different situations, in different societies, this was one of the only ways the Jews could make money. You know, so they had, you're caught between the devil and, you know, but that's why they forbade this. But you could understand the why it was so tempting. But on the other hand, it really caused them much, much difficulty. They had brought each other to different courts that the others didn't honor. You know, so he's brought, he says, you know, that the one court said, you know, that you have to honor this ruling, and or else, you know, this and this and that. And the other brought the other party to the court, another court, and said this. So he says, forget about everything. We're going to start new. You're going to take all of this to the fair, the Yerid in Lublin. You're going to have the greatest scholars that are not biased. They'll hear this case new, and whatever they decide, that's how it's going to be.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.